We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. The scientists of today no longer believe in the physical existence of race. Yet, in the minds of an awful lot of people, the belief in race, the belief that some races are better than others, persists. How did this association with skin color and beauty and power begin? That is a question that is at the center of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is The History of White People, and the author is our guest, Nell Painter. She's Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University. She's the author of a number of books, including this one. She served as president of the Organization of American Historians and also the Southern Historical Association. She is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. We'll be talking about this, some of the ideas in the book, which begins in the ancient world, where the concept of race, the concept that we have now, didn't exist, and certainly takes us through the invention of this idea in the 18th century and has something to say about where we are now with the idea of race and perhaps where it's going. Questions, of course, are welcome. Questions from people who are listening. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving, get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, your questions and comments are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that. The call's on us, 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments and questions to will-talk, that's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Professor Painter, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. I'll be glad.
Well, you know, I think I don't know if this is too large a question to start with, but clearly the argument that you're making here and other people would make is that race is not a fact. It is an idea. Given that, I suppose the question we come away with after the discussion of how it is the idea developed is why it is that it is so hard to shake.
Yeah. Okay. You know, an idea can be a fact, a fact of life, and that's what we've got. Anthropologists compare a belief in the biological fact of race with belief in witchcraft. It's something you never can disprove. For people who believe in witchcraft, there's always an explanation of why witches did it. So for those who believe that race is a real thing that is inside people, that is permanent, that goes across the generations, they cannot be dissuaded. So it can be a fact, but it's not a biological.
And given that there, in particularly in recent years, as genetic science has developed, and we hear more and more about that, and people are presented with the fact that at a very deep level, at the level of our genes, all people essentially are the same. What small differences exist, they're barely even worth talking about.
Yeah, this is not news. It became pretty clear in the middle of the 20th century that race had no biological basis, that it was an idea, a concept, a belief system. So this is not new, but our society is built on racial difference. We don't talk about class in the way other societies do, say Britain. So for us, the main way of dealing with human difference is by calling it race and pegging it to various racial differences. The point of my book, though, is that the ingredients of that notion have changed over time, and that race inheres in white people as well as in non-white people. And all around, the ideas have changed. The ideas have changed about what it means to be black or Asian, about what it means to be part of what were considered the alien races of the early 20th century. The notion that there's one big white race, that's something that dates from the second half of the 20th century. So all these things have changed over time. And in history, we can chase them. We can trace them. In historical parlance, I have historicized the idea of white race or white races.
Just for a moment, let's go back to the ancient world. And certainly the people of the ancient world, the Greeks and the Romans, others, I'm certain that they had a concept of the other.
Sure.
That is, they had this, they recognized the fact that there was us and there was them.
Yeah.
So then the question is, well, did skin color, for example, physical characteristics, what sort of salience did that have for them? Or how did they go about dividing people up into us and them?
Yeah. Certainly they could see skin color. They could see that people in hot places were browner than people in cold places. This was not a mystery, and they were not blind. The difference is that they didn't have a name for it, and it wasn't, to use your word, just a good one, salient. What counted was, for the Greeks, how people lived, where people lived, were their lands boggy, cold, hot, dry, windy? Did they live on horseback? What was their culture like? Were they warlike? Did they drink out of the skulls of their enemies and so forth? A sort of anthropological, what we would call anthropological issues. So what we're dealing with are the terms of human difference. For someone like Julius Caesar, who was a general, and when he was in Gaul, was dealing with his enemies, how they fought, how well they fought, how likely they were to be turned into soldiers. Those were the issues.
So they certainly recognized there were cultural differences. Yeah. There were differences in people's, in what they believed in and how they lived their lives.
Yeah, there were differences in how they looked. It's just that that didn't matter as much.
And that wasn't the important thing. They did not then draw connections between these other things and then people's physical characteristics.
Well, not their skin color.
Not their skin color.
Yeah.
Well, when did we start paying so much attention to the color of people's skin?
Mm-hmm. Now, people always noticed skin color. You know, this was not a mystery. People were not blind to it. It was what they made of it. And it started being an issue for classification or taxonomy, if you wish, with the Enlightenment of the 18th century. Before the Enlightenment, the terms of difference were religion. The term of difference was religion. And that persists in our world. But before the Enlightenment, if you sought truth, you went to religion. After the Enlightenment, if you sought truth, you went to science. And so science gave us taxonomy, and taxonomy gave us various themes, one of which what became racial. There are lots and lots of ways of dividing people up. The most popular 18th century way was by geography. So the different varieties of people accorded to the different geographical areas. There was a European variety, an African variety, and an Asian variety, an American variety. And for Jan Friedrich Blumenbach, who applied the name Caucasian to white people, there was also a Malay variety.
Well, as you say, we see at this time among natural scientists, this great enthusiasm for classification and naming things. You know,
and it particularly
was something that European scientists did as they got out into the world more and more and started to see all sorts of things that they had never seen before. Got very excited about this and thought, well, and particularly they thought, if we're going to be able to talk about this, we have to have some organized system so that when we refer to a particular plant, that everybody everywhere knows what it is we're talking about.
That's Linnaeus.
But it doesn't seem the case that in this kind of classification, you know, and there was looking at characteristics of plants and animals and things and saying, this is like this, but this is not like this, that there wasn't exactly this sense that there among these, say, among plants, for example, that there was some kind of hierarchy, that some plants were better than others. The idea just was, well, they're different, and this one has this kind of flower, and this one has this many leaves.
Yeah.
You know, how is it that we get from the idea that here among human beings we see this very interesting variety?
Yes.
Where did we get to the idea that there is something in terms of their development, in terms of their worth, this idea that, well, actually there's a kind of a ladder for human beings, and some people are up on the top of the ladder and some people are on the bottom.
Yes. The germ of this idea did exist in the 18th century. Linnaeus, the great father of taxonomy, did not rank things, but you can tell in his discussions that he clearly thinks that some people and some plants and some animals are better and more interesting than others. But the efflorescence of this mania for ranking, for hierarchy, is a 19th century invention, or not an invention, but a 19th century elaboration, I should say. And it has to do, I think, with empires with needing to explain why some people, say, British people, were lording it over a lot of other people around the world.
Well, that gets to the what seems to be the intimate connection between notions of race and power, and how it not only is it an explanation of what is, it's a justification of what is, and it amounts to not simply explaining things, but it amounts to saying that it's appropriate, it's right for it to be this way. That's a matter of its destiny that it's this way.
Yeah, one central crucial ingredient of race thought is the idea of permanence, that things cannot change. They are as they are, as you so eloquently summed up, and they can't be any different because of something in you, that is to say, the other people. And so no use agitating against it. This kind of racial hierarchy has been used to justify hierarchies of power, but also class differences. So the poor have been stigmatized by race, whether they are poor Irish Catholics or poor African Americans or poor Native Americans or, you know, the immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe of the early 20th century in the United States were stigmatized as alien races. They were poor people looking for work.
We have a caller I would like to bring into our conversation. And for anyone who's just tuned in, I also want to introduce again our guest, Nell Irvin Painter. She is a professor emerita of history at Princeton University and is author of a new book, one of a number that she's authored. Her brand new book is titled The History of White People, and it's published by Norton, W.W. Norton, which takes a look at how it is that the way that we think about race and talk about race today, where that notion came from, and her argument that if you look back into history, you find that it's a relatively recent invention, something that came up in the 18th century, the idea that there were races and that there were three of them and
five.
Oh,
or eight, or two.
Or depending. Well, see, now, again, that's I appreciate the, I take the point because yeah. because certainly we maybe get used to the idea. Yeah, they're you know they're white people, they're black people, and they're
yeah,
yellow
the
people.
The idea of three but is the 20th century.
No. The fact is, and as I think you really point out, is that there never has been a real consensus about this.
Yeah.
That different over time, different people have had different ideas, and even as you mentioned a little bit earlier, when you get to the point where people are talking about three, mm-hmm. that as far as Caucasians are concerned, the white race, there was this idea that well, yes, there's this one big bunch of people that are white people, but there were subcategories and subgroups, and that was divided. That also was divided up into distinct groups.
No, I have to demur here again. The idea that there was one big white race or one big Caucasian variety, yeah. to be exact,
yeah.
that variety went to India. It included North Africa as well. So, and that was one of many schemes. So there's no, the idea of three big races, the real races, that is a mid-20th century notion. And the idea that there's one white race that doesn't include, say, North Africans or South Asians, that is also a 20th century idea, a late 20th century.
We'll talk here with somebody in Urbana. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Professor Painter, where does Charles Darwin's ideas about the origin of the species and social Darwinism fit here? I'm thinking in terms of evolution and the linearity of it. I mean, you talk about classifications, which, mm-hmm. you know, white, red, et cetera, et cetera. But isn't the hierarchy factor a part of this, too, where white isn't just a group, it's the top of the group, you know?
Yeah.
And how does that intersect with social Darwinism in the 19th century?
Okay. If you let me move that to the 20th century, I'll feel a little more comfortable. But you've put three issues on the table, all of which are big topics, social Darwinism, and hierarchy. So hierarchy, I think, as soon as race became a way of justifying hierarchies of power, then we get racial hierarchy. And that varies from place to place as the need arises. One of my points is that there's no sort of knowledge out there that's freestanding that works at every place. That people use concepts of race as needed.
Okay.
So it depends on where you are, when you're talking, and who people want to stigmatize or elevate. As far as Darwin goes, Darwin put to rest, at least for a while, the idea that there was one, or for others more, Adam and Eve. So the idea that there was change over time. So this does not either invalidate or validate the concept of race by itself. However, the racial scientists used Darwin's ideas of evolution to apply them to races. So they used evolution as a way of justifying or strengthening their racial ideas. So, for instance, someone like William Z. Ripley, who was very important in the early 20th century, thought that whole races evolved so that there was the concept of race and it wasn't what we think of in terms of breeding populations, say, or individuals, but races. So the idea of evolution could be used for, against, beside, whatever racial thinking.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. And another caller here. This is line number two, and I believe it is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I agree 100% with the premises of your book. But in respect to that last question, do you know the concept of polygenism?
Yeah.
And that sort of touches on the idea of races being separately,
yes,
from evolving from separate policy,
yes,
populations.
Yes.
And I wonder what the current thinking about that is with respect to, like, maybe Homo erectus. Did they have evolved out of Africa, in, like, not in Africa, but in some other spot?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
polygenesis says that there are different origins. There are sort of different Adams and Eves for the different races. And this this runs into a problem because one of the definitions of racial difference or genetic difference is that you can't procreate and you can't reproduce, whereas all people can reproduce. So if you wanted to go as far away as you possibly could and then have sex with somebody, you would probably have a child, and that child would probably have a child. So this sort of undoes the idea of polygenesis. As far as what is going on now, now as in the past, there have coexisted competing notions about race, about how many races there are, about how to decide what makes them different, even about how many white races there are. So everything exists in terms of how people think. You will probably still find polygenesis, as you will probably find very few of them. But all those things still exist.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something that I'd like to have you talk about, this has to do with the origins of the term Caucasian,
yeah,
which is very interesting, and I think particularly because I think, as you point out, that here today in the United States, when we talk about race, there is this inevitable intimate connection between race and slavery. And here what's really interesting is that in the origins of the term Caucasian, there is also
yeah,
a connection between race and slavery and sex.
Yeah, yeah. Something that I discovered as I did my research. I started the book with that question. Why are white people called Caucasian?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are they called, in effect, Chechens? You know, this mm-hmm. didn't make any sense to me. So I started just looking for the answer. And I found the answer not in the Caucasus, not in the area between the Black Sea and the Caspian, but I found it in Germany, in Göttingen, Germany, with a scientist named Jan Friedrich Blumenbach, who in 1795 joined the word Caucasian to the variety, he didn't use the word race, the variety of Europeans. Not just Europeans, he included people from South Asia and North Africa in this classification. It was a very big classification. He used the word, he said, because the skull in his skull collection, he was a scientist after all, the most beautiful skull came from Georgia. I do not know why he didn't call his group of people Georgian, but maybe he knew about the state of Georgia in the United States, which had just joined the Union. He called them Caucasian. So that had to do with the skull was the skull of a sex slave who had died in Moscow. And so there I discovered this whole longstanding, when I say longstanding, I'm talking about millennia, of the slave trade out of Eastern Europe, out of the Black Sea region, out of the Balkans, out of and that was longstanding in Herodotus' time. So in that sense, the word Caucasian, its etymology, draws on this longstanding slave trade from what is now either Eastern Europe or Western Asia. It draws on ideas about beauty and also on slavery.
Hmm. And so that is the beginning of this association between lightness and beauty?
It's not the absolute beginning. I could trace the idea that Circassians or Georgians or Caucasians were the most beautiful people in the world. I could get back to Sir John Chardin or Jean Chardin in the 17th century. But it was not new even then. I could not get to the very, very beginning. I think it has to do with the Ottomans. I think it has to do with Europeans discovering this white slave trade. It has to do with the Venetians. You know, there's a lot going on there that I simply did not have the space to unpack in a book that was not just pausing there. But the idea that these people from this area where slaves came from were also the most beautiful, that's really intriguing. It has a lot to do with ideas of femininity.
And, you know, when one hears the story that this man, Blumenbach, had this collection of skulls,
yeah,
and that this one particular skull he thought was the most beautiful, yeah, I find myself wondering, and exactly what were the criteria here on which he judged the beauty, yeah, of his skulls, and why this particular one he decided that was the nicest skull, and then went from there.
Well, there's a picture of the skull in my book, and it is a really nice-looking skull. And I think a lot of that has to do with the youth of the victim.
Huh.
So I call her a girl, actually. This was probably a girl, a woman of 15, 16, 17, I would guess, captured and died of venereal disease. She has all her teeth, which means that she probably had never been pregnant or given birth. There are no dents or nicks in the skull, which happened to a lot of skulls. I mean, that's how you got skulls. The people were dead and had died of something violent. And it was really clean. So it was a very nice-looking skull.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here to talk with, and let's see, that would be someone in Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for having this guest. This is a wonderful conversation.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I'm particularly interested in the gender race connection. Peter Frost has a book called Fair Women, Dark Men, and he,
yeah,
claims in that all women in every ethnic group, mm-hmm, have considered, or the lightest skinned woman is considered the most beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that, and how does that play into the question of seeing these Caucasian women as the epitome,
yeah,
of beauty?
Yeah. Okay, so let me separate that into two parts. One is that there are a lot of white women in the world, and not all of them are beautiful. So we have to deal with something more going on. And then the other side, to the extent that beauty in women is linked to leisure, that is to say, not working, and for most of human history, working meant working outside in the fields, in the sun, yes, fairness in women has been prized. But clearly, people with dark skin have been finding each other quite beautiful, marrying, having babies, having brown babies, and so forth. So there is something to it, but that's not all there is to it.
Well, Marita Golden, in her book, Don't Play in the Sun, describes a dinner party where she goes to a very upscale Georgetown house, and it's got all this African-centric art, and everyone at the table is African-American, and she's very frustrated when she looks around the table that every single highly educated man there has a very distinctly lighter-skinned,
yes,
wife.
Yes.
So that I think it does play out, and his claim in the book is that in every culture, even if they haven't been colonized, even if there is no overt racism, that there is a preference you know, the higher the ranking of male, the more likely they are to get and choose a lighter skinned, whatever, you know, whatever color range they're in.
Now, this is very complimentary to white people.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
I'm wondering whether or not...
Yeah,
know,
and I think you need to consider the context in which this was written. I'll give you one example. In the 1960s, I spent time in Ghana, in West Africa. And in those days, there was not a lot of skin lightening, hair straightening, and so forth. That was the 1960s. Today, there is skin lightening and hair straightening. It doesn't mean that people's biology has changed. It means that they're more open to Western standards of beauty. So it doesn't surprise me that white people would be going around saying, we're the most beautiful. This is nothing new. The point is that things change over time. And to the extent that people are exposed to a power situation in which whiteness is power and beauty, then whiteness will be the face of power and beauty. So when our African ancestors were in, say, Virginia, they didn't say, oh, I'm not going to have sex with you because you're dark. No. I mean, how did we get so many various colored black people? It's because somebody was having sex with Africans.
I, you know, completely agree. But, I mean, as an anthropologist, he's claiming that he's done all this survey of the people, you know, again, historically, like, you know, Cleopatra bathing in milk to get lighter. And so long before the race took on the kind of context it has now, as a concept, that and he claims that it could be biological, that there's an evolutionary reason for like you are at your lightest when you're ovulating. Girls get lighter at puberty, so that there could be a kind of evolutionary desire to display lightness because, well, also you can flush and blush more easily, recognize the sexual signal if you're lighter. Does that make any sense?
As I said earlier, it does make some sense. I'm not dismissing it entirely. But for me, if not for you, the context in which this was written and the prevalence in our society of ascribing various social phenomena to either evolution or biology or genes or some kind of permanence, that, I think, counts more than the kernel of truth that may be there.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
are a society that seeks biological permanence.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously an easy
I think I've given you the best answer.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, all right, well, thank you. Questions, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free. 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I don't know if this is too much of a sort of side journey here, but I wonder in assembling this notion, where as people develop this association between certain physical characteristics and beauty, what role art, you know, painting, sculpture actually had in solidifying that in people's minds.
Yeah, art plays a big role because it provides the imagery.
Mm.
So one of my leading figures is a man named J.J. Winckelmann, a German who's considered the father of art history. And Winckelmann worked on antiquities in Rome in the 18th century. And his thought has been extremely influential in art history, and his aesthetic was one based on the Roman copies of Greek statuary. Now, the Roman copies were made of Carrara marble, that is, white marble, The originals, however, were made of various kinds of Greek marble and sometimes often painted.
Mm-hmm.
So for Winckelmann, the beauty was partly in the whiteness, also in the form. He was a gay man with gay male sensibility. So for him, beauty inhered in young men rather than in women. So art plays a very large role, and I do include some imagery of academic art in my book to show what has become of some of these images of actually slave girls. The most popular 19th century piece of artwork of statuary in the United States was Hiram Powers' Greek Slave, which was larger than life-size white marble young woman, completely naked except for a chain and a cross.
Mm-hmm.
This, it's kind of soft porn in a way. So people could look at this naked young woman and sigh over her beauty and look at art, not the flesh.
Mm. We have some other callers here. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Nell Irvin Painter. She is Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University and is author of the new book, the one we're talking about here, The History of White People, and it's published by W.W. Norton. And we have about 15 minutes left in this hour. We have several callers, so we'll continue and talk with people who are listening and talk next with someone in Champaign on our line two. Hello. Yes.
I just wanted to throw in a little exception that I found to the preference of lightness. My friends from Iran tell me that the girls of women of Shiraz are considered quite cute and beautiful and desirable, and they have darker skin.
Mm-hmm.
And they look like they have really good tans, and they're just considered quite desirable. And that's the only exception in all my amateur observations that I've ever found of preference for darker skin.
Well, what you need to do is go to places that have not been penetrated by Western media. And I think there's one criterion which is absolutely necessary for female beauty, and that is youth. I think that is universal.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to throw that in. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go have another someone somewhere in central Illinois. They're on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I have a couple questions. The first question is, do you think, what I was wondering is, what were your personal, professional reasons for writing on this specific topic? And secondly, do you see your book coming out in audio on CD, and I'll take my answers off the line. Thank you.
All right.
For audio, right now there are no plans. Write to W.W. Norton and say you want one. The personal reason, and this is going to sound kind of corny, very 20th century. Back in the 20th century, there was something called intellectual curiosity. When I started working on this book, I had already done, this is my seventh book, and I had done five. So, you know, I had done plenty of books. I could just follow whatever I wanted to. So I started by thinking, and this was when Chechnya was up in flames, why are white people called Caucasian? So I started with a question. I didn't know where it was going. I had nothing to prove or disprove. So it was purely an intellectual indulgence, if you will.
You know, when you say it that way, and I remember the 20th century, you say it that way that there was something called intellectual curiosity that makes it sound as if you think that now here we're in the 21st, that somehow we've lost that.
Yeah, I think that there's supposed to be more of an argument these days.
Huh.
You know, to be on one side or another or to have something to prove, that maybe just following your curiosity seems too whimsical, too dilettantish. I don't know. But it does seem to me that maybe there's a better word for it now or a new word for it. But intellectual curiosity was what got me started.
Well, let's talk with someone else, another Charleston person this morning, and line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, since I'm from Ghana, since you mentioned Ghana, three things come to mind.
Yes.
One of the earliest histories of the Gold Coast, written by Reverend Reindorf, talks about a local chief meeting a Dutchman, a white man, for the first time, and thought he was very ugly.
Yes.
So what are, well, the history of white people, what did other people think of white people? I mean, what? How did other people hierarchize people who did not, Africans, for example?
Yeah.
How did they hierarchize Europeans and Asians?
Well, you're getting into an area that I brushed up against and realized I just couldn't deal with because it was too big, you know, the world. But I do remember, and this may be from Ghana also, an 18th century Ghanaian saying that when people were hauled up, no, it's Equiano. It's Equiano saying that when he was put on the slave ship, he was afraid of the white people because they looked like they were dead. And it, in many parts of the world, white is the color of mourning. So people either paint themselves white or wear white to designate the closeness to death.
Well, maybe there's a quick follow-up. Which, broadly speaking, which racial group do you think is under a greater influence of these ideas? I'm asking because I find it very hard teaching my African-American students because many of them have come with an experience of subjugation and have internalized the logic of it. Some of my white students come to class the first time and say, now, we don't know anything
about it. Let me interrupt you. I cannot classify people by race in the sense of what they think. People think all sorts of things, and they do not accord to what their race is.
Yeah.
But we are in a society in which our imagery, our media, are drenched in images of white people. And even though things have changed a lot, the images of beauty and power are still overwhelmingly white.
Yeah.
You cannot dismiss the history of the United States and the history of people within the United States. So it's not wrong of people to have the history they have.
No.
I don't think that there is any race or that is more or less susceptible. I would look at where people get their news, where they get their magazines, what they see online. You know, what are people exposed to in terms of their culture? Thank you.
Perhaps.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this hour of Focus with Nell Painter. Questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, earlier in the conversation, I talked about the idea that there are three races. And you rightly corrected me and said, well, you know, really, you have to bear in mind that that is a, that's sort of the most recent.
No, it's not the most recent.
Okay. Well, here's what I'm going for, I guess. I'm thinking about how over time, if you had asked various people who were thinking about this, you ask them this question, how many races are there? I hope I'm on our right ground here, that over time, different people are going to give you different answers.
Yes.
They're going to, they'll be, everybody will sort of have this different number. So well, I guess what I'm getting, I'm going for is, well, wherever we are now with it, how is it that we've come to this idea and how, particularly how is it over time that it tends to narrow?
Truth is, race is an idea. It's a concept. It's not a biological thing.
Right.
So there is not a right answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
So what answer you get when you ask that question depends on whom you're asking, when, and for what reason. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, one of the leading figures in my book, Franz Boas, the 20th century anthropologist, keeled over dead during the Second World War in the Columbia faculty room. And at that time, his prize student, Ruth Benedict, was going around saying that there were three real races. And as he keeled over, cigarette in hand, a wine glass in the other hand, he was about to say, no, he thought there were four. So you can have as many as you want. And where you ask the question also will give you a different answer. Mm-hmm. So if you ask the U.S. Census, you will get a different answer every 10 years.
So where then, where, I'm not even sure what question I'm trying to ask here. where do you think we are headed? How about I ask it that way? Here in America, uh-huh. Most people, the way they think about race, and where do you think that's going, and is it likely to change, particularly, and where we're going to get, away from the kind of racial thinking that, yeah. that scientists say, oh, that doesn't make any sense anymore. But as I said in the beginning, in the popular mind, that's still there.
Yeah. Now, you've heard me now for close on an hour. You know that I'm a splitter, not a lumper, but I'm going to try to give you a lump answer. And I think the lump answer is that we're moving toward black, not black. So lots and lots and lots of different kinds of people will be in the not black category.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in the black category will be poor. There'll be poor people with dark skin. How's that for a simple answer?
I'm not afraid of more complex answers. That's what we encourage on this program, I guess. If that's the way that we're going, that sounds kind of disappointing.
People dealing with race are dealing with ways of talking about human difference.
Yeah.
And so the discussion is bound to be about difference. Not about unity or peace or can we all get along. Difference is written into the classification. The fact that it's part of classification tells you that we're not going to get to unity. If you want to talk about our getting together, then you use different terms.
Well, and I suppose it also, which you say, also makes me think about class.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also something actually in this country we really don't like to talk about.
We use race as a proxy.
And that those two things are, we can't quite disentangle them, I think.
Until we can face race squarely, class squarely as a matter of income and wealth, we will probably be bogged down and going in circles about race. But in a very general way, white functions as middle class or upper class, and black functions as poor. So if you want to talk about black people who are not poor, you have to add a modifier, middle class.
Uh-huh.
And if you want to talk about white people who are not middle class or rich, then you have to add a modifier, poor.
Uh-huh.
So I think that kind of zero degree of thinking will persist. After all, our country was built by slaveholders whose slaves came from Africa. And it's going to be very difficult for us to get... I mean, if there's anything in our cultural DNA, that's it. So I think black-white will be with us for a long time, or black-something will be with us for a long time. A binary that has black in it. But what the other term is changing over time, and that's one of the themes of my...
We're getting very short on time. I'd like to try to maybe at least include one more person here. We'll go to Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hi there. A minute ago I heard her say that race is not a scientific classification. And
I'm sorry. It was a scientific classification.
Well,
it is not a biological.
That's what I was going to ask them. What is the biological differences between issues between the three races, or as we call them, races, or that you mentioned earlier, or whatever. What is that biologically called?
There aren't
a difference biologically?
There aren't.
Pardon?
There aren't. If you want racial difference, you have to have race, which is a concept, not a biological fact.
Well, when they have two kinds of birds that are identical except for colors, isn't there some kind of differentiation for those two
branches? It depends. In many species, the male and the female are different colors.
Okay, but I'm saying...
I understand what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying.
You're wrong.
I'm sorry.
You're wrong. In many,
I'm not wrong. I'm asking a question. I don't understand. I'm trying to find out.
Okay. You want to talk about different colored birds. Birds are different colors in different parts of the year, and sometimes the male and the female are differently colored.
Well,
are you saying that they belong to different
I'm talking
races?
About just the biological names. I wonder what... Why there isn't an extension for that? It seems like
they're called cardinals.
Okay. All right.
Well,
that was less than enlightening. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
I guess we're going to have to stop. I hate to stop on such a confused point, but if people are interested in reading more on the subject, you should look for the book that our guest, Nell Painter, has authored. It's just recently out. The title is The History of White People, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Nell Irvin Painter is Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University. Professor Painter, thank you very much.
Thank you.